Hi, welcome to my 28th diary entry. It's crazy that about 28, there's literally like two more after this. And honestly, it's kind of a good thing that I sped things up a little bit as I was working on this project, because we just got an email yesterday from our prof saying that like our due date is kind of pushed forward. So at least I'm not like too behind, which is really good. I feel really good today. I woke up, I had a good sleep. I was dead yesterday, but I had a good sleep. Woke up, was productive, you know, cleaned my room, organized my stuff, watched a documentary, which I'll be talking about, and I'm just planning. Like, I have a lot of schoolwork to do today for my class with Bill Hutchinson. My story is about secret raves around Toronto, which is really cool to work on, so I'm going to work on the video for that, maybe even the audio if I have some time. I wanted to exercise and go to the gym, but I just didn't. I'm not going to. I might go to the mall for a sec. It's my friend's housewarming later, and I just want to get her a little plant to, you know, welcome her into her new home. That's really exciting. In terms of the world right now, we have won quite a few Olympic medals, which is, honestly, I'm not going to lie, I'm surprised. Mr. DeGrasse, let's see his first name. Mm-hmm. Andre DeGrasse, there you go, he's a Canadian sprinter. He won I believe a gold medal, yeah, in the 200 meter race, and that's just incredible. He's definitely that was a YouTube video just opening up right there. He's definitely just such a, like, becoming like, you know, one of the icons in our culture now. You can see him, his name being everywhere, people talking about him, everybody's just very proud. And I think that that's important, you know, especially during this kind of time of life where the last few years have been a mess and Canada has, you know, dealt with a lot. So it's nice to have that kind of recognition, that kind of celebration happening. My mom, actually, she works out at Lifetime Fitness, which is like close to my house in Mississauga. It's a huge, huge gym. It's beautiful. And there's like a big pool there. And she was swimming in the pool the other day, and she saw this girl, probably like 17, 18 years old, something like that, like maybe 19, actually, not sure. And she was wearing a swimming cap that had the Olympic thing on it. And the man, she overheard a man asking her about the cap and being like, hey, like, are you in the Olympics or were you in the Olympics kind of thing? Turns out she was. And she had just gone back from Tokyo. So my mom was just casually swimming beside an Olympic athlete, which is kind of cool. but yeah, so today I want to talk about a man named David Geffen. I had never really heard of him before. And so he's still alive right now. And I kind of mentioned this in the text that I'm going to post with the audio here. And I had said this a little bit before, because I think I did this for one other person in my entries. But I was trying not to pick people who are still alive, not because they're any less valuable in history or anything like that, but just because I wanted to kind of focus on the history as being like legitimately in the past, and in my head, you know, knowing someone's full life is very helpful when you're talking about history and telling those stories. Does that make sense? Like if someone were to pass away 10 years ago, we would have an idea of their entire life and the entire impact that they made. And that's kind of what I wanted to why I wanted to pick people who had already passed, just because I could get a really full feeling of who they were as a person and what they had done in their life, in a historical perspective, as opposed to someone who's still living now, who could still, you know, maybe tomorrow he'll do the most amazing thing and I didn't speak about it, and it's not the end of the world, but it's just like, you know, it's this anxiety in me where I'm like, I want to know everything. But anyways, so I chose him because I had to watch a documentary about him literally like 5 seconds ago. And it's on Netflix. It was a really good documentary. I had watched one about Clive Davis, who kind of connects to him in some ways, and like a long time ago too. And it was so inspiring to me at the time, Clive Davis's story and Clive Davis's life and impact. And watching David Geffen's story was kind of similar. And I wanted to talk about like just the fascination that I have with those two figures and their impact, as well as how it kind of applies to me now and inspires me now for my own self and my own future and everything. So David Geffen was born in 1943 on February 21st. He's actually 78 years old right now. So he's born in New York City. I believe it was in Brooklyn. And his parents were, I think, immigrants who had come from like the Ukraine. They were Jewish. And they came here with not much money, as a lot of immigrants did. And they lived in kind of, not, I wouldn't say poverty, but definitely on the poorer side of scale, a scale of things. And so they did what, again, a lot of immigrants did, and they opened up a shop, or his mother opened up a shop, a clothing shop, where she would make and sew clothes and all that stuff. And, you know, she was a very impressive woman from what the documentary said. Like, she was strong. She worked hard. She was, you know, strong-minded and, like, had a good, this big personality where she kind of knew that she would always have to work and always had to push herself further and to be better and to try new things in order to be successful and make money and to support her family. And, you know, she definitely instilled those traits into her son. And so she kind of told him at one point, and this was, and they say this in the doc, where she was like, you know, you're always gonna have to work your whole life. Like, you hope you like working, because you're gonna have to do it your whole life because we don't have a lot of money. And he was like, yeah, okay. And he had said that, like, he wasn't very good in school. Like, he just didn't enjoy school that much. He didn't get the good grades. And at the time, it wasn't like a hidden thing. Like now, like, if you're not the best student, grade wise and stuff, like, teachers are not gonna expose that. Other students are not going to expose it or talk about it. It's like, you know, we don't kind of stand for that sort of shaming. And he, at the time, he had dyslexia, but at the time, nobody knew really what dyslexia was or cared what dyslexia was. So they just thought he was, quote unquote, stupid. Like, he just felt stupid. Like, that's what he said. So people would, you know, make, like, straight up say, like, you know, tell him that he's not a good student. His teachers, everybody knew, everyone knew. So he never really felt like he could succeed in the ways that other people did, just because obviously in school he felt like lesser than. But he really didn't really want to stay in Brooklyn at all. He was so interested in California and that kind of ideal world that come, that fantasy that came with it, you know. Like, at the time he was like 18, I think. At the time it was like the late 50s, early 60s. I think he was like that fantasy of California, the beach, the beautiful women, the success, the money, the movies, all of that stuff. So when he was 18, he went to California. He just went straight there and went to Santa Monica College. But then he ended up leaving that school as well and wanting to get a job. And he wanted to work in the entertainment business. And somebody had told him, so he worked actually in the mailroom at the William Morris Agency. So somebody had told him that in order to like be successful, like, he'd have to, so he worked on set for a lot of places, and somebody on set told him he should probably be an agent, an entertainment agent for musicians and for actors and actresses, or sorry, actors. And so he was like, yeah, sure, that's cool, because he was like, I don't have any education, I don't have any, you know, experience necessarily in this industry that much, so an agent is probably the best thing I can do, because it doesn't require any of that stuff. So he went back to New York and again worked as in the mailroom at the William Morris Agency, and eventually he became a talent agent there. So he actually lied about being a college graduate. He like put, you know, just wrote that he was graduated from the University of California on his application, and he worked in the mailroom. So he knew a guy there that like also lied about it, and that guy got caught and fired. So he was stressed out. He's like, oh my god, I don't want to get fired. So because he worked in the mailroom, he like looked through every single letter before everybody came in to work for like a couple weeks or something. Finally he found the letter that said, hey, you know, he's actually did not graduate from the school, and he changed the letter to say that he did. So he was definitely, you know, willing to do anything to succeed. He was, I don't want to say sneaky, but like a little sneaky there with his you know, application, but it ended up working out for him. So slowly he rose and rose and rose, and he was just very like passionate about his job. Work became his life. He was super like wanting to succeed, etc., etc., and he did. He was very successful with a woman called Laura Nero, who was a singer-songwriter. She wrote a lot of songs that a lot of other bands play and sing, and she's also a singer herself. So she was kind of like the Joni Mitchell vibe. And he loved her so much. Like, they became amazing friends and also, like, colleagues. And he also worked with Crosby, Stills, and Nash, who were obviously very famous. And then he ended up making his own record label because he felt like he wasn't getting as much recognition for the artists that he wanted to support. He made his own record label called Asylum Records in 1971. That became massive. He booked signed artists like the Eagles, Joni Mitchell, Bob Dylan, Tom Waits, Warren Zevon, Judy Still, like literally so many huge, huge names. He was very successful in the 70s and just kind of like blew up from there. I'm just reading this now, and apparently in 2004 they kind of revived the label, and then there's like hip-hop artists like Gucci Mane, Waka Flocka Flame, Mike Jones, Bun B. That's really funny. I don't know why. But anyways, so in 1975, that's when he kind of left that company and worked as a vice chairman for Warner Brothers Film Studios. Because so he was dating Cher for maybe like a year and a half or so, and he was so in love with her. He like his whole life was, you know, a gay man. Like, he lived as a gay man. He was very open about it. But he ended up falling in love with Cher one night. He like met her and they went on dates and stuff. He said in the documentary that was his first like heterosexual relationship, and he was so in love with her. And they had a really great time when they were dating. They were like so close, got along so well, but she ended up, I think she broke it off, or she just started dating somebody else, and it kind of ended that way. And he was like so heartbroken, so upset. And so after that, like, he was very like all or nothing. So he obviously felt like he gave her his all. And because when they broke up, it kind of like a big part of him was like taken away with that relationship. So he was very like making like impulsive decisions, big decisions, because he was so distraught and felt like shaken up. That's what he kind of mentioned in the doc. And with that came that shift into the movie business. So he became the vice chairman of Warner Brothers Film Studios. And his personality was very direct. He was very like, I will tell you to your face, I'll be straight up, I'll be honest, I will get what I want, like, very straightforward. And so he did. He had that same personality in the film industry, and it wasn't the same as the music world. Like, he just clashed with a lot of people, butt heads. People didn't, you know, they ended up firing him pretty much. And he was like, okay, cool, cool, cool. So what do I do now? And then he founded, in 1980, after that, he founded Geffen Records, so named after him. And then he recruited Warner Brothers Records to kind of work with him. And that worked out for him. Obviously, seems like he was a little bit more suited to the music industry at this point in his career. He just knew the ropes and the people. And he signed a lot of huge people like Donna Summer and John Lennon. During the time where John Lennon actually got shot, like, he was there. He was working with Yoko and John, and he worked with Elton John. He worked with, I think Bob Dylan was the, no, not Bob Dylan. There was one, he worked with Blink 182, Guns N' Roses, Nirvana, Lifehouse, Olivia Newton-John, like, Cher as well, Aerosmith, Whitesnake, Neil Young. Okay, there you go. Neil Young, I believe. He ended up suing Neil Young because Neil Young made music that like wasn't like what he thought was Neil Young type of music, and it didn't do well sales wise. So he sued him. It was a very strange era, I guess, in lawsuit. And Neil Young was like literally speaking in interviews in the doc. He's like, I basically got sued for like being myself. Like, I just made music that I liked, and like, it didn't do as well, but like, then I got sued for it. He was like, it was really weird. But he ended up like kind of retracting the lawsuit, and they're really good friends, him and Neil Young. So it was kind of like one of those awkward things where it's like, sorry, bro. Like, you know, he just made the wrong move there, but it was interesting. And so he threw all this, you know, huge success in the 80s. And he also worked with movies through the Geffen Film Company, which he had just created. As well, because I guess he got like more knowledge in the business. And he made Little Shops of Horrors in 1986, or he was helping with these remakes, with that remake. He worked on Risky Business, Beetlejuice, Dreamgirls later on, and Cats as well. Those were the musicals. Like, so it was on Broadway. It wasn't on the movies. But he was so successful with these as well. Clearly, they're massive, massive movies and massive names. And then in 1994, so this is like, and he became a billionaire, like at all of this point, you know, he had so much money, so much success. People knew him in both music and the movie industry at this point. He was worked with huge people his whole career. And then he co-founded DreamWorks with Steven Spielberg and Jeffrey Katzenberg, who are also huge names. And we all know how what happened with DreamWorks. It became, again, massive. And this was like the first studio that was opened, like film studio, in so long in the States. Like, you know, they were working with like Warner Brothers and GM and, is it GM? Is that, oh, MGM, my bad. And, you know, all those massive, massive names from like before old Hollywood or around old Hollywood that were huge. They opened a new one, and like that's pretty rare. And obviously all these people are extremely talented and have a lot of money as well. So they were successful for many reasons, but also they had the resources. And, you know, of course, DreamWorks made Shrek. DreamWorks made, what's that movie with, oh, Saving Private Ryan, just all kinds of huge hits, and obviously made tons of money, and they're still, you know, active today. So that's pretty much, you know, and then at this point, you know, he's much older as well. He was involved in a lot of philanthropy as well. Wow, I just like stuttered for like 2 minutes. He helped with helping people with AIDS. He helped, you know, School of Drama, at Yale School of Drama. He helped like a lot of different universities, School of Medicine, New York University School of Medicine, different things like that. So he was very involved in philanthropy as well. I can't, like, this word philanthropy, I guess I'm messing it up a lot, sorry. He also was like very an early supporter, like financial supporter of President Bill Clinton. They became like best friends, super super close, but they actually like parted ways, or like weren't really close anymore after Bill Clinton kind of said he would be helping the cause of helping gay men join the army, and he didn't actually follow through with his word. And so Geffen was just really upset by that, because not only was he doing something he didn't agree with, he was also like felt betrayed. Like, you said you were going to do one thing and you didn't do that. And interestingly enough, actually, I didn't even mention it. The woman he first worked with, ooh, sorry about that, my phone rang. One of the women, Laura Nero, who he first worked with, that he was first successful with as an artist, like back in the day at his beginning of his career, she also betrayed him at one point. She said she would sign with his record label when he first opened it. She didn't. She signed with like Columbia or something. And he was so distraught and heartbroken. Like, he was sobbing for days, apparently, because like they were like family at that point, like close friends, you know, had worked together for years. He trusted her. She trusted him. And it was like behind his back, she had done that. And anyway, so he's a very all in kind of person. And yeah, so that's pretty much him. I mean, he's still living now. He's 78, like I said. I'm sure he'll do more, you know, like still has quite a few years, I'm sure, ahead of him that he'll be able to do more. He also had a cancer scare. He was diagnosed with cancer kind of around the time where him and Cher were dating and broke up. And for a couple of, like, I think 4 years or something, he thought he had cancer, bladder cancer. They told him and everything. You know, he's dealing with all these emotions and thoughts, and how am I going to live my life, and da da da. After that, turns out he was falsely diagnosed. He didn't actually have it, but that also changed his perspective. So that was on life and who he wanted to be, and etc. So yeah, he went through a lot in his life. He did a lot of incredible things, and that's why I wanted to talk about him, because like Clive Davis, who I mentioned before, who I watched a documentary about, they were kind of like, you know, doing their careers around the same time. Clive Davis, I believe, is also still alive. Actually, hold on. You know, it was kind of like that rise in music where there's, he's 89. Wow, so he's like 10 years older than him almost. Actually, yeah. And Clive Davis still alive. So both of them, but specifically Geffen, were involved in like a time period where music and culture changed so much. Like, they were there from like 50s, 60s till Oh my gosh. One second. I'm so sorry. Oh, sorry about that. I just had to tell her that I would call her back. But okay, real quick. I'm almost done. So from like the 50s to like literally the 90s-ish, 2000, early 2000s-ish, I would say, probably early 2000s, both Clive Davis and David Geffen had these incredible careers where not only did they work with artists that literally changed, you know, music in so many ways and revolution, like think about the music from the 60s to the, even the 80s. That's so drastic of a difference. You know, you have like Guns N' Roses rock and roll, and then you have like, you know, Elvis rock and roll kind of thing. It's very different. So they were just involved with, you know, the entertainment music industry throughout all this time, worked with incredible artists. Not only that, though, is that this is what impresses me and amazes me. There's two things. One, they were part of the discovery process of these people and believed in them. So it's like, let's say I, you know, met Joni Mitchell or whatever, and I just heard her singing at like the bar. You know, I'm scouting for new artists, and I hear her, and I'm like, wow, she is just, her voice, her talent is incredible. I'm going to go out of my way as an agent or as a head of a music company like Clive Davis was, and get her a record and get her out there. And that's what they did. He literally put himself on the line, reputation, his career, for artists that he discovered, for the most part, ended up being huge household names, incredible, like, you know, artists and talent. And not only that, and this is the main amazing thing that I think is so cool, it contributed so much to culture. It's like, music is music and it's great, and you can kind of just leave it at that, I guess. But the truth is, no, music is not just music that's fun to listen to. Music is a part of our culture. It brings us nostalgia. It brings us like identity, all the things I've been talking about in all these other entries. It all connects. It's like, when you really like a band or a song, a lot of times some people are huge fans. They love them. They put posters everywhere. It becomes part of their life. They feel connected to that artist or to the lyrics or to the song, or it's connected to a bigger purpose. Like in the, you know, 60s and 70s, music was connected to the activism that was happening, or in the 80s and 90s, that grungy kind of outlook on life and that grungy style, like Nirvana and all these things. Like, and then when you add movies to the mix, now he worked in movies, and the music that was in those movies, as well as just the impact of the films, like, that is, you are affecting not just, you know, the entertainment fun stuff, you're also affecting people's lives, like the things that they grow up with, the things that they treasure, the things that they make them feel comfortable, comforting music, comforting you know, movies, or things, music that they play at their weddings, or music that they, you know, they dance and they celebrate to with their friends at New Year's, or they make the best memories with, or whatever. Like, it's just so impactful, even though, you know, he's doing more of the business stuff, and he was very into the arts side of things as well. But it's just incredible to me that one person, and it's not just him, he worked with a bunch of people, obviously, who really made this happen, but just, he had clearly, from the doc and from everybody's conversations, such a massive impact on the industry and the way it worked and the artists that he discovered, that without him or talent like him in that space at that specific time, a lot of the culture that we know today probably wouldn't have come about the way that it did. We wouldn't know the artists as much, or like the Eagles. He helped bring the Eagles together as a band. The Eagles are amazing. We wouldn't have them, maybe, you know, it's like things like that. Same with Clive Davis. Honestly, I recommend watching a Clive Davis documentary. He worked with incredible artists, literally had the same talent, like the ear for artists, from like the 50s to like the 2000s, which is insane, because not only is he just incredible at having that ear and the business perspective, but also he's keeping up with the culture, because music, again, connected to culture. It's just, that is so inspiring to me. And the last thing I want to say is really kind of just like the way that he was, his personality, I guess, and his ambition was really cool to me. He was like, kind of like, I'm going for it. I'm doing it. I'm not letting anybody stand in my way. He didn't come from a successful background with resources and money. He was, you know, poor, from a family who, you know, wouldn't necessarily have gone in that direction career-wise. Like, it's not like his family was in the music business or anything like that. He kind of put himself there. He went for it. He didn't take no for an answer. He succeeded. And he, like, some stuff I'm sure was a little sketch and not very nice, stepping on people's toes. I personally wouldn't do that, but just the concept that he kind of like pushed through challenges in order to get to where he was, and through that impacted culture, impacted the world. And you know what? We probably need people like that in the world who are more ruthless. I'm not saying ruthless in a disrespectful, evil way. No breaking laws, no hurting other people. And that's not what I'm talking about. When I say ruthless in this case, I'm talking about business ruthless. Somebody who's willing to make their plans, business plans known, and going for it and taking that ruthless step, almost spending all that money and doing these things in order to achieve the vision that they have, like that kind of ruthless. So I don't know if ruthless is the right word. Honestly, I feel like it'd probably be more like ambitious or something. I don't know why I said ruthless, but he's definitely somebody that's has a huge impact on the world. And I feel like that's super cool. It's cool when you see how one person can change a lot of lives, not only with the people he worked with directly, but also indirectly. Like, you know, my parents, they obviously, they're immigrants as well from Lebanon. So they had a little bit of, you know, they listen to different things maybe growing up as people in North America would, but they definitely know 90% of the artists and listen to them that this man worked with, for example. So it's like just thinking about how much their lives were affected, and the people that everyday people just know and love the music and the movies and everything that he put out. So that's that for today. I'll probably make another one entry tonight, because you got to do what you got to do to get this project done. Bye.